dispensing with the regulations into battle override mode on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing. Watch it.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Meters are metering. Meters.
Fantastic, then. Let's get moving, the cameraman, Tim.
The cameraman has been shot. The meters are metering.
We've got more uprising in the face of the COVID-19 crisis yet again. Neither you nor I nor Archie the podcasting dog is yet to be afflicted by the disease. So as long as that's the case, Tim, we're going to remain as first responders on the podcasting front, putting out the content for those who need it even more than ever. They thought they needed it for their lengthy commutes, Tim. They have no idea how much they needed for their lengthy non-commutes. So,
well, honestly, you speak to something that is representative of the opportunities that have been derived from this crisis. And one of it is that a place like LibertyNation.com now has a bigger platform than ever because there's so many more people who have time on their hands. They have to figure out how to fill it. They can read books, yes. They can watch more movies and binge watch more, yes. But they're going to also hit the internet on their favorite subjects more. And so we have a bigger voice than ever, Scott. And I think we do seriously have more responsibility.
Let me pause your response there and let's get the players laid out. I am Scott David Cosenza, the legal affairs editor for LibertyNation.com and host of this program, The Uprising Podcast. Tim, you are the immediate past co-host and have had other roles, all of which have expired or been taken from you. Timothy Elting Donner, who is
I'm
trying to lay out the accurate. I'm trying to lay out
roles,
the accurate.
None of them worked out. You know, we're desperate.
And yet still you're here. And yet still.
With a dunce cap.
And yet.
To make the occasional, you know.
And yet you are still here.
Comment.
And don't run roughshod, Tim, over Archie the podcasting dog, who is playing injured today and may or may not make an appearance. So
playing injured. We need the details on that.
Well, we'll provide them perhaps.
You can't just drop that in and say, yeah, and then not describe the injury.
But we are doing the podcast for the host of the show, which is LibertyNation.com, a website available internationally. Any place somebody can access the commodity internet, Tim, they can get our products, including written pieces, the podcast we're talking on now, another podcast called The Rabbit Hole, your radio show and other things. But more importantly than ever is for this week for us to talk about LN Gen Z. And LN Gen Z is a website designed for students, people who are in elementary school through high school, to get a understanding of the core principles that sort of, you know, have made this country what it is. And it's presented with a conservatarian bent, if we're going to say a bent at all. And people out there that are struggling to wonder what they're going to do with their kids' education because they have to kind of supplement it themselves or teach them about these things, it's a great place for them to go. So go there yourself. And if you don't have kids and you got a niece or a nephew or a grandkid or a send it to them. You know, any parents that are looking for good educational materials, for people that don't know, that's what LibertyNation.com started as, a project of One Generation Away, which is a project to get the ideas of the founders to be taught in our nation's schools and for people to learn them, because you and I and all the people that make up both LN and One Generation Away, that's our motivating principle, is to see that the principles of individual liberty are ensconced in these institutions and are picked up by the people, because that's how we can live free lives, is by when our neighbors respect those ideas and those institutions as well.
You said something before, which referred to what we do in a way I hadn't heard quite before, which is the commodity internet. I think of that as, you know, trading commodities like in trading places, you know, like frozen concentrated orange juice, right, and stuff like that, commodity internet. But you're calling what we do a commodity. But that's just an aside. But, you know, LN Gen Z, you know, it's obviously directed to Gen Z. So we put it in the name so that more people would know exactly what it is just by the name. And I think that Liberty Nation is the same thing. They look at the title, Liberty Nation, and they know we're into liberty. It's not much doubt about it. But the point of LN Gen Z is to fulfill what we've been doing the last 8 years, Scott, which is the mission statement of our parent organization, One Generation Away, which is applying America's founding principles to the issues of today. And that's exactly what LN Gen Z does from a freedom perspective, really from a, as a catch-all phrase, Scott, a constitutional perspective.
Well, Tim, that is also what the uprising does. So let's get right into it and apply those founding principles to the issues of today, namely COVID-19. You know, I wrote, the first piece I wrote this week about this was on the sort of federal versus state response. We had Governor Cuomo urging, Tim, and so there was a lot of back and forth this week between Cuomo and Trump. I don't think you caught today's version. We're recording right now. It's 3:19. That's the date, not the time. At 2:54 p.m., these facts seem to change so fast, I think, you know, it's even more important for us to time and date stamp this stuff. So Cuomo and Trump have been going back and forth a bunch this week. First, it was Cuomo saying we needed more of a federal response. And then the last part was him saying, well, he talked to Trump and he did kind of put in a federal response. But the joke of it was that Cuomo was asking for Trump to kind of become a dictator, as I see it, with his want for Trump's grant of authority. He's out there saying, well, forget the buildup. Here he is.
You and I were both in the federal government. We understand the capacity. There has been no country that has handled this, Joe, without a national response. And we've been behind on it from day one. I'm not giving up. There are things we need the federal government to do. You look at today, the news, all these patchwork acts by these different states. It makes no sense for me to take an action. I close bars and then people drive to New Jersey, right, or Connecticut, my neighboring states. You need a federalized response.
Now, Tim, freedom is just so messy. You know, we need, if we could just have a dictator who could just wave his hand and then everybody would just do what he said or else. Wouldn't that be such a cleaner way to go about governing the
Scott,
world?
It's not like the left hasn't coddled dictators for as long as we can actually remember. But I think what's going on here is pretty simple, is that, you know, Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, has proposed among, if not the most drastic measures in the country, which means shelter in place, which means basically it's martial law.
I actually
in
think
the sense that,
that I think you're that, maybe that, giving out bad information. All right, Tim. I want to just issue the correction because I think you were saying that Cuomo said something when in fact it was de Blasio that said it. And also it's bad information even when de Blasio said it. So what it was is that de Blasio basically said people should have to prepare to shelter in place. And my neighbor is chasing his dog onto my in front of my front window, like 10 feet from where I'm recording.
This sounds like a scene
where I'm recording.
Christmas Vacation.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like the majesty of a winter thing.
Right.
emptying his.
By the way, it is kind of funny. Like, there's this weird, like, snow day thing happening in the neighborhoods, but also there's no snow. Like, people are home. There's, like, a little bit of oddness out. You see your neighbors more than you do.
It's the whole climate now is almost surreal. I mean, you could put a timestamp on this. And this is the time we usually record the podcast on Thursday afternoon. But, you know, like I said to you before, it almost feels like a time warp or the Twilight Zone. I mean, it could be 10:30 in the morning. It could be 6:30 at night. It's like hard to, because we're all locked into a different reality. And I guess the best you can say is that hopefully your abode is nice enough that the minimum security prison that it's been turned into can contain you for the duration of this.
Tim, the freezers are still at acceptable levels for the moment. We'll see if that holds out. I have yet to consider harvesting some of the local fauna. So in any case,
how about the flora? How about the flora? Flora, fauna.
I don't think there's a whole lot there for me in the flora, but the fauna. So de Blasio says they may have to consider sheltering in place. Cuomo comes over the top, says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." Right. Absolutely not. You know, he's thinking of a vision of checkpoints and guards at intersections and bridges and tunnels. And he's saying, no, I would be the one that would issue or could issue those commands, if at all, not de Blasio. And I am not going to do it. And he actually, in his press conference earlier, earlier today, he basically said he regretted the way he said he was the thing with New Rochelle, where he said he was sending in the troops to aid the people of New Rochelle, like with food delivery and that sort of thing, not, you know, to lock it down is how it was presented by the press. Basically, it was hilarious, Tim, because both he and Donald Trump spent a bunch of their time today admonishing the press for their accounts. But Cuomo himself did say that people would, that the Army Corps of Engineer would be able to build hospitals in 3 weeks, somehow thinking that they were like a ninja-like construction brigade instead of what they are, is they're permitting and, they help, people stay within the bounds of federal law with that kind of thing.
Well, what the governor has done is request, like you said, an extremely aggressive role for the federal government in the response to this whole crisis. And it's understandable because, yes, he's not the one that would have commanded a shelter in place, as is his authority, as he asserted, as you said. However, he will bear the responsibility of Bill de Blasio taking as aggressive measures as possible, or as he cares to or is allowed to, as the mayor of New York. And then Cuomo will bear the financial, economic responsibility of what happens. I mean, New York, it's hard to calculate now, but New York, you've got to figure, is going to be hit at least as hard, if not harder, than any other state because of the concentration of commerce, of finance, of money on Wall Street. And
Tim, because of the concentration of people per square foot.
Absolutely.
That New York City is
the whole thing. So what
ideal breeding ground for this sort of thing.
He's trying to lay the groundwork for the federal government to step in and just bail him out completely. And you know what? He's entitled to try and do that. And Trump is entitled to push back to the degree that he cares to. But this
you know,
is
I don't like that, Tim. I don't like that analysis because I love hating Governor Cuomo because of all that his family has done to me and liberty over the years. But I think that's a prescient analysis, and I think you're right. And it's good. It's good governing. In other words, he's protecting his state's interest, right, to get off the hook for this kind of thing and put it on the burden of the rest of America.
Right. Yeah. And yet, at the same time, realizing that he's got a guy like de Blasio, who somehow has been elected mayor.
Right, he's going to screw it all up for him. You can see him on the phone like, hey, you mind if we duck a punch or two over here? I'm trying not to go bankrupt over this thing as an entire state. But
we duck a punch over there. That's nice. I like that. Nice the boxing thing, Philadelphia, Rocky.
Cuomo actually had his daughter there in a good way. It was one of the first times I saw a politician use their kid for good. And he was basically saying, you know, hey, if you're a young person and you think this isn't affecting you and it's okay to just be normal about it, basically, please, please don't.
I wanted to point to the actions and the involvement of governors like Cuomo and like Gavin Newsom in California, and like the governor DeWine in Ohio. And in Florida as well, and other large states particularly, that this is an instance where all semblance of partisan politics must be put aside. And we're largely seeing that. And you know what? This will be about the most idealistic thing you'll ever...
By the way, good luck, but go ahead.
This is the most idealistic thing you'll ever hear me say. But if George W. Bush and Tom Daschle could share a heartfelt hug on the floor of the United States Congress in the aftermath of 9/11, bitter political opponents, then certainly Schumer and Pelosi and Trump and all the rest of them can put all the partisanship aside, just for now, just till this is over. Just put it aside and say, we have to work together. We have no other choice. And you know what? I think what that could do ultimately, okay, we don't need the hug on the floor of Congress, but you've got to think that it could ultimately make both Trump and the Democrats realize that they are trying to protect the same nation.
I see them both holding on to every political advantage they can in a way that is off-putting. I see the Democrats attacking Donald Trump politically and inappropriately, to my mind, meaning, you know, criticizing the response, not because there's a warrant for criticism or that'll actually make something better, but just to try to gain advantage. And I see Trump, you know, today he was talking about, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but it was like, you know, and then in comparison to like something Obama did, like, you know, like, okay, we could, you know, we could just hold on about the Obama comparison and just appreciate, you know, what you've said you've done. Both of them are fighting for political advantage, it seems to me, within the context of their response.
Of course they are. They're politicians.
Yeah,
these are people that make their living in politics. But you know what? The people are watching. They're watching what Trump's doing really closely because they're dependent on what he's telling them each and every day. He's the one guy that has to be in charge at the top. Somebody has to lead the effort to try and somehow keep us afloat and then drag us out of this when this is all over.
With that in mind, Tim, it was really funny where he was like at the end of his thing, after like, you know, discussing all the horrors of the thing, he's like, you know, we had the best economy we've ever had before this took us down. He's like, and I think it's going to come back even better than ever. It's just like that salesman part. You just can't beat it out of
him. Election campaign.
Yeah. I mean, I actually was going away from politics. I'm not joking. I think that's actually a leadership part for some significant portion of the economy runs on good feelings and of what's going to happen in the next quarter, the next year, whatever, right? So if a positive outlook can be maintained, or at least the lack of a really negative one, that might actually mean the difference between a depression and a recession, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Now, I put up a piece, a column on LibertyNation.com.
Tim, you're mentioning Thursday. Hold on just a second. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for today's show, LibertyNation.com. And among their products is a website called LN Gen Z. And Gen Z is a project of LibertyNation.com whereby people can get educational material. So if you've got a kid who's home from school, or you know somebody else who does, a neighbor, a friend, your grandkid, niece, nephew, send them to Liberty Nation Gen Z. They'll really be able to benefit from it. Please go ahead and talk about your piece.
So the column was entitled, Is Trump Equal to Such a Time as This? And what we're going to discover, and we think we know a lot about Donald Trump now, we're going to find out an awful lot more because he's being called on to do things he never thought he would have to do, that every president knows is possible, but almost all of them short of FDR, Pearl Harbor, George W. Bush, 9/11, maybe LBJ after the JFK assassination, these national nightmares that turn the entire country on its head overnight.
An event that in the future people will regard where they were before the event versus after the event. One of those markers.
That's absolutely. And there's very few of those. I think the three I mentioned are the only ones. And of course, you and yes, God, I were not around for December 7th, 2021. I'm just going to cut you off at the knees with the inevitable cheap joke that's coming down the pipe from you. But I mean, Trump, look. Does Trump have what it takes to get us through this kind of crisis? He has governed, I think, no matter what you think of his personality, he's governed with strength and fortitude. He's turned around a lot of things. He's shaken things.
No matter what you think of his Twitter feed.
No matter what you think of his Twitter feed. But now the challenge has changed overnight for him like it did for George Bush after 9/11. And so we're going to have to see some qualities in him that we haven't needed to see yet because we haven't been in a true crisis. And so the evaluation of this president in terms of reelection, I think, has changed completely to primarily how did he respond to a rocky start,
to be sure. And I mean, to call a spade, Tim, he's a bullfucker. And that's full of bluster. And I think even his, you know, people who vote for him and his fans would be comfortable with that description, you know, by and large. And that's not a great match for somebody, I think, in this crisis.
I don't share that. I mean,
okay.
First of all, you can't really be a president and be a BS artist because it's recognizable enough to enough people that a guy could never be elected. So when you say a BS artist, it means is he P.T. Barnum? Sure.
I mean a guy who goes on and on about calling the Ukrainian phone call a perfect phone call. And like, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
That's a concerted strategy, Scott. I mean, that's a concerted political strategy, which is I'm not going to give an inch of ground to my enemies. I'm not going to stipulate anything because I know what these people are like and they're out for blood and I'm not going to give them an inch. I'm not going to tell them one thing that's going to help them. Can you blame him, Scott? Can you?
Well, I wouldn't blame him for that strategy, but I don't think that changes my assessment of his verbal style. And again, I don't think it's an attack as much as it is a general way of being for him. So
let's face it. He's a president like none other. I don't think anybody.
My point, though, but just hold on a second. My point was just that particular aspect of him, I think, is particularly ill suited to dealing with a daily press conference where it's important to get every jot and tittle just right. Because, Tim, one of the problems that I've had with, and I see you want to come in here, just give me a second to get this point out, which is that one of the problems that I've had with the reporting on Donald Trump is Donald Trump will say something like, it's a perfect phone call. And then instead of the Washington Post, say what's wrong with the phone call, they'll actually post a English teacher's review of the grammatical errors that occurred during the phone call to counter the point that it was perfect, rather than just saying that he didn't actually mean it was grammatically perfect. That's kind of pedantic sort of response to him, which I'm not in favor of, except that now it actually may really be important that he only say things that are literally true during this sort of exchange in order to get the good info out for us. So that's why
I understand it. And this is exactly what I'm saying, Scott. This is exactly what I wrote in my column, which is that this president is going to have to reach deep within himself and find qualities that have hardly been associated with him, that are not in his wheelhouse, that he's not used to. He's going to have to project enough strength. He's going to have to hold the confidence of the American people, half of whom don't like him, and 75% of those people actually despise him. He has to lead those people too. He has to find a way to unify people. This is not something that he's been used to doing. This was not his platform. This is not what his presidency was about. I mean, any attempts at unity, which I think there were many and they were genuine, but they were immediately hit with the back of the hand from Democrats who refused to accept his election. So now he's in a spot here where he is simply going to have to perform. He's going to have to get it done. He's going to have to figure a way. He's resourceful,
all right.
Scott.
Well, let's get into what that those things should be. What should the president be doing and not doing? Because I think that what I've been seeing done, to me, Tim, is the reasons why we got into this, why the mess was so bad in the first place, and a number of the problems with the response are all government problems. And some of those are Donald Trump problems, but mostly they're about government that existed in the last administration, the one before that, too. And the only reason why they're you could call them Donald Trump problems is because he didn't act as aggressively as he could have before now to have them removed. But that's maybe an unfair, criticism. But like, so for instance, why are there too few masks involved? These N95 masks. Well, today there was a ruling where they said that the ones that hadn't been labeled for hospital use could be sold to hospitals. That's one of the things about, you know, how government hurts this problem. You know, how difficult do you think it would be to start an N95 mask business today? If you had, you know, you think the manufacturing capacity to do so, Tim, how many rules, regulations, and laws, how many lawyer letters do you think you would need to get to put your factory at risk, to put your shareholders' investments at risk, your own livelihood at risk, to just step up and start doing that? And then to be confident that you're going to be able to give those or sell those to people for this disease. Like, in other words, the government burdens on the response to this are massive.
I see other problems down the road with this, with the injection of politics into a national health crisis, which, again, I'm going to keep repeating it, and it should seem obvious, but I'm going to keep saying it should be devoid of politics. It should be strictly what can each of us individually, whether just a citizen or a politician or in the media, what can we do to help? But you know what I see coming down the road, Scott? I can just see this. Because these masks you're talking about, they'll produce more of them. More people will be able to get them. Or the testing kits, the swabs, whatever you want to talk about, the things that there's a sudden need for. There's going to be a distribution of it. Some people will be able to get it. And the people on the left are going to claim, I'm just saying this as a marker right now, they're going to say, oh, well, there's racism because not enough black people, not right. enough people of color right. were able to get the masks and the swabs and the other things that white people were able to get in a higher percentage. CNN will do a big study about how X percentage of black people couldn't get them.
Well, while you know, X percentage one of the jokes, of white could. One of the.
Am I wrong or am I right?
Well, you're right, except for this one point, which is, and I'm not saying this is true, but one of the things that is out there in the world is this idea that black people can't get the COVID-19 or are less susceptible to it, which is interesting. And if it's true, it's actually. You know, the idea that this disease spreads differently in different ethnic populations is one of the many things about it that may be true and interesting. Also, that you're not allowed to talk about it. You know, that's one of the consequences of a society where you're not allowed to say people are different. If a disease treats people differently, Tim, on the basis of their ethnicity, then are we allowed to report on that or not? But yeah, the old joke that you didn't exactly allude to, but it's world to end tomorrow. And the headline in like the Washington Post and the New York Times is, you know, women and minorities affected worse, hardest hit, you know.
And I haven't read that thing about whether African-Americans are not subject to this at the same level, especially when you're getting a high profile guy like Kevin Durant, the NBA.
Well, by the way, you just made – I have to interrupt you, Tim. I know you're going to love this interruption because here's what. You made a mistake that was driven by political correctness. I said black people couldn't get the virus. You said African American. I'm talking about black people, including the African blacks.
Oh,
in other words,
yeah, that's good.
But yeah, it's like the actual people in Africa too. They're saying that.
Good for you. Oh, I'm so impressed. You want to be more inclusive. So who's being politically correct here?
Point is, though, like infection rates, the Chinese are all throughout Africa. They own Africa in many ways. But the infection rates of the actual Africans seems to be make it out like this disease is not as, you know, it doesn't affect those populations as virulently as it does others. Namely, I think Han Chinese. Anyway,
Now, here's what's interesting. I want to get this in before I forget. Lisa K. Donner, who doubles as editor-in-chief, and my wife, not necessarily in that order, depending on the day, she's written a piece on the reliability of the information that we're getting on the coronavirus. In other words, we have to assess the information in terms of its reliability. And one of the things she brings forward is there's very few reliable test samples because each country is different. They each have different policies. They each have different demographics. Italy, for example, is an older country than us, and they have different measures. They're also dealing with the EU and its open borders. Okay, that's different than it is in China, which is different than it is here and everywhere.
And they have fewer acute care beds per thousand population. All that.
In other words, the variables are way too many in order to put together a worldwide death rate, for example. However, there's one example of a closed environment that we ought to be looking at, which is that cruise ship, okay, where there were 700 people who were quarantined in what became a closed community, a closed environment. Seven of them died. Seven out of 700. So you're talking about 1%. Now, these were also people, and you can read this column at libertynation.com, but these were people who were definitely beyond the average demographic age.
Cruisers are old as it could be, for sure.
Exactly. So it's not, so there were, you know, there's generally few people, let's say under 40, under 50, and definitely under 40 on these, tend to be on these kind of cruises. So, I think that's one marker we could look at in terms of just how damaging are we at that 1% death rate realistically, because we're getting higher in some countries. And then others like South Korea, for example, they closed their borders immediately, had almost no infections. So, you know, again, government policy being different gives us unreliable information. There was, for example, for the longest time, Scott, there was the sense, or what we thought was the proof that we had at that time, that it's only old people and people with underlying medical conditions who are really subject to serious problems from this virus. But now in France, suddenly there's a bunch of younger people, millennial age, who have been struck down by it and are experiencing symptoms, or more than just symptoms, but are, you know, pretty much bedded down with it. So everything we think we know can change with each passing day.
Yep. Which is why government response, Tim, should be avoided when private response is possible. There was a story in the news about Amazon not accepting shipments to their warehouse that were not, you know, of high need in this environment, including, you know, we know all the goods we're talking about here, right? The toilet paper, the hand sanitizer, all that stuff they want, and they don't want, you know, extra Rubik's cubes or whatever it is right now that they're saying you can hold back on. Although that is a good bug-in self-containment game to play.
I think there's more demand for it now. So it's a hard decision to make because the demand for stuff from Amazon has got to be going through the roof when people can't even go out to buy stuff.
But the point is, they didn't need, Tim, a act of Congress to pass that. They just were able on their own to make a policy that benefits them. You know, there's
remarkable.
They could do it all on their own.
Incredible.
There's this one of the things that Cuomo kept going back to again and again in his various addresses. There was one he was on Morning Joe on MSNBC, and there was another address, sort of like directly a statehouse address, is this thing about the ventilators, that we need so many ventilators. And in fact, there was a question from a woman to Donald Trump from the press gallery about the ventilators. And the funny thing is, the question from the press, and I wish I had it, the clip, unfortunately, it was too close to our record time for me to grab it. This woman asked Donald Trump, like, what he's doing about the ventilator situation. Like, there was some strategic ventilator reserve right now in, like, the Dakotas, and we're just sitting on it, like, waiting with our twiddling our thumbs before we disperse them to the 50 states. It's like, you know, we're not responsible. The federal government doesn't have a built-in response to any possible thing that may come about. And let me ask you a question, Tim Donner. Do you think that the guy who's in charge of the ventilator company production, you think he's in, you know, a Caribbean island right now doing nothing? Or do you think maybe they're working right now to build these ventilators? And if they're not, maybe federal regulation or something has something to do with it. Why don't we do this? Why don't we go and give every ventilator employee a 10-person federal concierge staff so they don't have to worry about where their kids are going to school or getting them meals or doing whatever, and just support ventilator production that way rather than this want to seize the ventilator company, okay? Yes. Yes. Okay? By the way, yes. These are the people who are making ventilators already. They're doing God's work already, right? And you're going to seize their company? Why not aid them? Why not buoy them?
You're not even necessarily even talking about seizing their company, but there's talk about, like, a Lee Iacocca with a Chrysler bailout by the federal government of actually taking an equity position within individual companies that could either be hit hard or that would give them the power to increase manufacturing.
Oh, I think you're wrong about that. No, those are two separate things. The equity position would not be if they want to take control of their production. I don't think that the government gets an equity position there.
But they could take an equity position for any variety of reasons. The point is that they're that's the kind of thing that's actually on the table. Again, we haven't seen it since the 1970s. But the other point is that, you know, this crisis, in a way, like the other ones, once they start to settle in, the view of what's being done is entirely dependent on what your worldview is. So the people that you're talking about that are saying the government should do this and the government should step in, these are people that say that in every instance, the government is the answer to the problem. So this is the last instance in which they would pull back on that belief because they know they have an open field in front of them, Scott, to use a football analogy, an open field, because who's going to stand in the way of them trying to spend more, regulate more to help the stricken American?
I can't imagine what could retard ventilator production more than the government assuming control over a ventilator company. I mean, that to me is like the worst possible thing. Why don't we do this? Why don't
Why
don't we do this? Why don't we give them a 100% profit bonus over and above every ventilator they produced for the last quarter, for this quarter, or a 1,000% bonus if they need, like, well, let's incentivize their production rather than do this horrible, heavy-handed government thing. And
that's exactly the role of government. The role of government is to lay the groundwork for private industry to be able to thrive and create jobs, which creates tax income, et cetera, et cetera. That's the proper role of government, is to simply make it possible for private industry to thrive.
All right, let's talk about these subsidies now. You know, I actually think that, well, first of all, let me just say, of course, that I find no provision of the Constitution that allows the Congress to allocate the people's purse to the American Airlines company or any other private company, and I find it odious to the Constitution. I think it's horribly consequential in many negative ways to our economy, and their mischief will haunt us. That said, if it's going to be done, I do want it to be in the form of an equity position, because otherwise it's just giving money away to, let them buy the stock back if they want it at a profit for the people. But the idea that we're going to give American Airlines $1 billion and then really we're giving it to the shareholders of American Airlines and then they can come back and still treat me poorly and steal my frequent flyer miles like they already did, Tim? I don't believe so. No, sir.
It all depends how it's managed. For example, well, this may be the only example we can actually come up with that we know of, that you and I know of, the Chrysler bailout in the 1970s. They were thought to be you know, a significant piece of American culture and a critical part of, obviously, the auto industry, one of the main manufacturers. They'd been mismanaged into oblivion. Lee Iacocca came in and promised that if the government would take an equity position, would bail them out, would come in, that he would not only rescue the company, but would turn a profit back to the government, which is what happened. So like you said, we know that if the government does take an equity position, then we will benefit when the company, as right?
Well, Tim, let's just reassess that whole situation there, because if I recall correctly, one of the outputs of the of that whole thing was the K car. And whether it's in the form of the LeBaron or any of its other vestiges, I don't think that it's appropriate to count that.
The other day,
Tim, that's not
LeBaron driving down.
Was it a convertible? That's the only thing that makes sense if it was.
It had a damaged convertible.
When you add up the pluses and the minuses from the K car throughout history mean that it's not bueno, my friend. Okay.
I'm not saying the product was good, but I'm saying that the company was bailed out and it was returned to financial health.
It's not the business of American politicians to do with the people's purse what they please. It's their business to obey and follow the Constitution. And giving private loans to companies because they happen to be too big to fail is not part of it. It's disgusting. It's odious to the Constitution. So, it was wrong when they did it with Chrysler, and it would be wrong for them to do it with American Airlines this week or next year.
Well, you talk about winners and losers. In the 2008 global recession, there were winners and losers, to be sure. And let me tell you something. You know, here's someone who was hit extremely hard. It was almost a death blow. A friend of mine was expecting an inheritance. And all the money that he would inherit was invested in Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Lehman Brothers was allowed to go under. Everybody lost everything, and other institutions were allowed to survive.
Right, well, so why was it okay to pick a winner? Right, why?
It wasn't.
Why?
That's the whole point. Yeah. It wasn't.
Yeah. If the market picks them, that's okay. Okay, whatever. I don't want to say it's okay that somebody lost their shirt, but this is the face of reality. That's why they should divest if they need to. But it's not for the president to decide these things, who should be the winner and who should be the loser. And just like these regulations right now, they're deciding who can avoid the regulation and who can't. The better position is to let the market decide. Even now, Tim, part of the things that they've done when they've changed the regulation is they have given an additional grant of immunity from suit for some of these things, for like the rubber glove and the mask manufacturers. Now, that's something that I think is an imposition on liberty, meaning those grants of immunity come with a cost, for sure. And to the extent that they're just given out willy-nilly, that one company can produce a good without having to worry about being called into court for any of the various torts they may commit while putting that to market, and company B, who doesn't have friends in the legislature, has to worry about that continuously. Well, that seems to be an untenable position for us to be in.
You know where I think we are, Scott? I think we are right in the middle of the fog of war. We're in a war against a virus, against a terrorist virus. That's essentially what it's like. And in war, as they say, your battle plan goes out the window when the first shot is fired. And now we're in the middle of a war where everything, shots are being fired every which way. We don't know who's going to be killed, who's going to be saved, what's going to be saved, what can be saved, when all the fog starts to clear. But there's no question, Scott, that there's all kinds of impositions that are constitutionally questionable at best. Expansion of federal power. It's a frightening time. Crisis in Leviathan. You can go through it again about how crises are what sparks expansion of federal power every single time. And they don't give the power back.
Well, I think I said on the radio show, it seems like we're on a two-track sort of existence here. On the one track, it's, you know, we get these stories about these mayors, like, getting the power to ban gun sales and, you know, de Blasio talking about shutting down New York and this. And then on the other one is this rush of, like, oh, there's some imposition to you actually helping. Well, let's knock down this regulation and that regulation. And people realize how stupid these regulations are. There's no benefit. I mean, even the police stories about them, you know, going easy on custodial arrests. Well, maybe go easy on custodial arrests, you know, every day of the year.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say, while I think of it, that another institution that's likely to undergo serious reform in the wake of all this is the Food and Drug Administration, because some of the waivers are being granted for products that are only at the intermediate stage of development. And if some of those drugs, and most of them are antiviral treatments we're talking about, if they do prove to be effective in the treatment of this, there's going to be heavy pressure on the FDA to loosen the reins on the approval of new drugs that in many cases are available in other countries around the world, but not in the U.S.
Every time somebody from the FDA approves a big new drug, they stand up and they say, X number of people a day are not going to die because of this drug. Like, they had something to do with bringing it to market, by the way, which they didn't. But in any case, that's how they act.
All they do is
Right. And so the right thing to do is, and I do this now, I mean, sincerely, I take the day that the application was submitted, and I subtract it from the day they made that announcement. And then, you know, that's how many people died every day while the bureaucrats were waiting to approve the drug, right? Meanwhile, we have a system right now where even if a drug is approved, even if the federal government says it's okay to sell it and something bad happens to you when you take it, you can still sue the drug company, right? They still have that problem. And there, everybody, you know, these anti-capitalistic types love to talk about how much money the drug companies have and how rich they are. Why not let them bear the burden, Tim? If they're willing to put their money on the line and sell me XYZ drug, knowing that I can tie them up in litigation for eternity and have them pay me out for eternity, if they do, in fact, sell me the bad drug, why can't we just let that be the system? You know, if there's go ahead.
Trump was on board with this in another iteration of the same argument. Early in his administration, you may recall, he passed what I believe was called the Free to Choose Act or whatever that allowed...
He talked quite a bit about that today and the success of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Terminal patients to use what are considered experimental drugs that have not been approved because they're in a state where they have nothing... If somebody has nothing to lose and possibly everything to gain, let's let them go ahead and do it. That's exactly the kind of regulations that you're talking about, Scott, that stand in the way. What if 1 out of 100 are saved from an experimental treatment? Is that not enough right there?
Well, absolutely. It should be open to all of us to decide for ourselves with the best information that we can gather to direct our treatment rather than the federal government, which we know is horrible at these things. Number one, they often have bad information. Number two, they're the exact opposite of nimble. So, for instance, these dietary guidelines that say we should be eating all this grain, you know, the wheat products, basically. Those are all the things that the food scientists are telling us, you know, this wheat belly thing is bad, right? That's what's making people fat. So, really, there's so much bad advice out there. Well, and that's why the federal government should not be in the advice of, A, picking winners and losers in the airline industry, because we know if they could do that, they would be investment analysts for Wall Street rather than working in the federal government. They're not good at that. Or what to eat. Just provide us with liberty. That's the one thing that they can do. And, of course, that's the one thing that they're not great at going ahead and doing.
The federal government subsidizes tobacco production and then brings the executives of tobacco companies in front of Congress and reads them the Riot Act. Enough said.
And creates a system whereby the pack price of cigarettes is elevated in order to create this fund. But then they engage in anti-smoking campaigns, which will hobble the thing that has to be funded by the continued purchase of it. All right. Well, let's end, Tim.
Your tax dollars at work.
Let's end, Tim, on a completely non-COVID-19 story. I do have one that I brought to the table, and I just thought it was remarkable, and so remarkable, Tim, because of all the things you'll hear me talk about Donald Trump, eloquence in statescraft is perhaps the least that one might think I would say he has exhibited, and I believe he has exhibited it here. I think it's pretty interesting. This is about this guy called Austin Tice. So Trump added a couple subjects to his big press conference today on the coronavirus, and one of them was a story out of Beirut where they got some hostage back. But that was, I thought, not the main story, Tim, which was he talked about this guy Austin Tice and how he wants him to be released by the Syrian authorities. But it was unlike any other kind of action I've heard from a president of the United States. He just kind of laid it out there and just asked them to do it. He didn't say, like, or we're going to X. You know, there was no stick involved, and it was sort of devoid of that posturing that I think is so common. I just thought this could be remarkable. Like, if this was successful, imagine that. He just kind of, like, appealed to their humanity. He talked about the man's mother, and Mr. Tice is a guy who, they called him a freelance journalist. He was involved in lots of different media organizations reporting, I think, from Afghanistan, I guess it was Syria, when he was taken. And so he's like a Syrian hostage, and there seems to be some debate about whether he's alive or not. But this was Donald Trump on Mr. Tice.
Recovering Americans held captive and imprisoned abroad continues to be a top priority for my administration. We have one young gentleman, Austin Tice, and we're working very hard with Syria to get him out. We hope the Syrian government will do that. We are counting on them to do that. We've written a letter just recently, but he's been there for a long time. And was captured long ago. Austin Tice, his mother's probably watching, and she's a great lady. And we're doing the best we can. So, Syria, please work with us. And we would appreciate you letting him out. If you think about what we've done, we've gotten rid of the ISIS caliphate in Syria. We've done a lot for Syria. We have to see if they're going to do this. So it would be very much appreciated if they would let Austin Tice out immediately.
Have you heard a plea like that before?
No. And you know, Scott, here's what I was thinking as I was listening to him. That this is a man who right now has been humbled. He's been humbled in a way. I've only seen him truly humbled a couple of times. This is one that through this whole thing. And I follow his body language, and I follow the expression on his face. And I think it's only the last 2 to 3 days where he's really gotten his footing on this. But the only other time I saw him humbled was when he walked onto the stage on election night 2016. He had to look like, I can't believe I actually won.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the body language in the face was, this was Donald Trump being humbled. Notice the moment, because it doesn't happen often. But he's humbled here. And you can't, Scott, as an effective chief executive, get out there and start threatening foreign governments when you're in the midst of a crisis like this.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's reflected in his remarks.
Well, we'll see if what other policy, decisions are informed by this humbleness. I wonder what else is out there that we might see.
Well, Scott, you know, it's exactly what you said, and it's what I wrote, which is, this is the biggest test of his life. Does he have what it takes to get us through this? Because the qualities required are not ones, and I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt here and say not ones that he's been required to demonstrate, but also ones, let's face it, that people don't think he has in long supply. But it's up to him to reach within himself and see if it's there, because if it is, this is the time to pull it out.
All right, from your lips to God's ear, Timothy Elting Donner, Archie the Podcasting Dog, this is Scott DiCosenza for LibertyNation.com and the website Generation Z, where you can check out all kinds of great educational materials for all the kiddies, from high school, grade school, middle school, you name it, they're home. They got nothing to do. Put them on, get them learned right at Liberty Nation Gen Z. And check us out next week and tell a friend. That's all. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening, watching, and enjoying.
Liberty Nation Gen Z. Becoming a strong defender of freedom and liberty doesn't just happen. It's taught. LN Gen Z is your portal for news that's hot, engaging articles without the spin. Go to LNGenZ.com for riveting videos that foster critical thinking. Download worksheets and quizzes for each age level. At LNGenZ.com, the future starts today. Combating propaganda. Defending freedom. LNGenZ.com. A free thinking future starts here.